Alaska is the home of missile defense for all intents and purposes in the United States.
Vice President Mike Pence emphasizes Alaska's strategic location. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 6th. Good evening. I'm Rachel Waldholz. Also tonight, China aims to increase its presence in the far north.
China is determined to better know the Arctic, protect the Arctic, utilize the Arctic, and participate in the governance of the Arctic.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Vice President Mike Pence stopped in Alaska last night on his way to Asia, where he'll lead the U.S. Olympic delegation in South Korea. At Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage, Pence talked about beefing up the nation's missile defense system and deterring North Korea. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell has more.
During his refueling stop at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage, Pence toured the Alaskan Command Center and met with Governor Bill Walker and top military officials. He took questions from the press inside an airplane hangar at J-Bear. Standing in front of an F-22 fighter jet, the vice president emphasized Alaska's role in the American missile defense system.
Alaska is the home of missile defense for all intents and purposes in the United States, particularly with regard to the rogue regime in North Korea. And Alaska is ready, and America is ready.
More than 40 of the nation's ground-based missile interceptors are housed at Fort Greely in the interior. Pence's visit was a reinforcement of Alaska's strategic importance. But at the upcoming Olympic Games, North Korean athletes will team up with South Koreans, a move that has eased military tensions on the peninsula. Still, Pence says the nuclear threat from the North should not be underestimated.
Whatever cooperation that's existing between North and South Korea today on Olympic teams does not cloud the reality of a regime that must continue to be isolated by the world community.
The Trump administration has used harsh rhetoric at times against the regime in North Korea. But as Pence reminded the press at the airplane hangar at J-Bear, Trump is a talker. So a meeting with members of the regime isn't completely off the table when the vice president is in South Korea.
With regard to any interaction with the North Korean delegation, I have not requested a meeting, but we'll see what happens.
From Alaska, Pence flew to Japan to meet with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe before continuing on to the Winter Olympics in South Korea. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
At its most northern point, China is hundreds of miles from the Arctic Circle, but its leaders want a say in how the region is governed. As Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports, China's first ever national policy on the Arctic reveals its expansive ambitions in the far north.
This is from China's Government Information Office as it announced the new policy.
China is determined to better know the Arctic, protect the Arctic, utilize the Arctic, and participate in the governance of the Arctic.
The policy says China will cooperate with others on development in the region, including new shipping routes it calls a Polar Silk Road, after the ancient trade routes connecting China to Europe. New Zealand professor Anne Marie Brady says this is the first white paper China has ever issued for a region outside its own territory, and it demonstrates the country's growing assertiveness in global affairs.
China is stepping into the power vacuum of global leadership since the Trump administration came to power, and it's preparing to shape the new world order.
Brady spoke at a forum organized by the Wilson Center, a Washington, D.C. think tank. Another participant, Robert Daly of the Kissinger Institute, says it's natural for China to play a major role in the Arctic, particularly when it comes to science, trade, and financing. But he says the big question is how other countries are going to react. Daly says the Chinese policy uses certain phrases like the shared future of mankind, to portray itself as a benevolent force, interested only in economic globalization.
But note that the last sentence of this important document reads like this: China will advance Arctic-related cooperation under the Belt and Road Initiative. That's about as important as a preposition can be in this world. Under the Belt and Road Initiative.
Belt and Road is the banner for how China wants to expand its influence around the world. It's a global development policy Chinese President Xi Jinping announced in 2013. Daily says extending that China-centric policy to the Arctic isn't a good idea.
China's participation can be welcomed within existing frameworks, but this notion that China will lead it under Belt and Road has to be resisted, rejected, countered.
China is not brand new to the region. It's had observer status at the Arctic Council since 2013. The country has one polar icebreaker and is building a second. And it's a major investor in Russia's Yamal liquefied natural gas facility. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
State Senator Dennis Egan says he won't seek re-election this year because of health concerns. As KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports, the Juneau Democrat broke the news on the radio station he once owned.
More action line in minutes. Senator Egan made the announcement Tuesday during a live conversation with KINY's Pete Caron. The 70-year-old Douglas resident said he has health issues, including a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. That's given him severe vertigo that makes it hard to travel.
Driving across the bridge, no problem. But if I go down to the docks and the motion of the channel or, you know, whatever, it just drives me crazy.
Egan said he won't seek re-election because it's difficult to visit the communities he represents.
I don't think it's fair to my constituents in Haines, Skagway, Gustavus, Clickwan. Even the night watchman at Excursion Inlet, it's not fair to them because I have a heck of a time traveling and I can't visit those communities. It's not fair to those folks.
So far, the only person to file a letter of intent to run for the seat is Larry Cotter. The 65-year-old resident of Thane near Juneau is retiring as CEO of APICTA, the Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association. Cotter has been registered as both a Republican and Democrat, but says he'll run as an independent.
I look at what political parties have been doing the past several years in both the Congress and at the state levels, and it's pretty hard to tell what parties stand for anymore.
Another possible contender is Senator Egan's own staffer, Jesse Keel. The 41-year-old Juneau Assemblyman is a registered Democrat and says he's considering a run if there's enough interest.
I still have a lot of listening to do and a lot of considering to do, and I've committed to work for Senator Egan through this legislative session. So a decision is a couple months away, but it's definitely something I'm thinking hard about.
Senator Egan is the son of the late Bill Egan, a former Alaska governor. He was a mayor of Juneau and appointed to the Alaska Senate by Governor Sarah Palin in 2009. He won re-election in 2014 after winning 72% of the vote. He represents District Q, which encompasses a middle section of southeast Alaska, including the cities of Juneau, Haines, and Skagway. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how bears are spreading berry patches in Alaska forests.
If they really, truly are the most important seed dispersers, that sort of is understandable then why you have so many more berries in Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
For the last couple years, school districts across Alaska have had to wait in limbo as state lawmakers struggled to pass a budget at the very last minute. Now, some lawmakers are trying to put an end to that uncertainty by forcing the legislature to pass an education budget first. In the House, a bill sponsored by Homer Republican Paul Seaton would split next year's education budget off from the state's main budget so it happens sooner this session. It calls for pulling about $1.3 billion from state savings. In the Senate, a bill sponsored by Kodiak Republican Gary Stevens would enshrine that process in state law going forward, requiring the legislature to pass a separate public education budget by April 1st of each year. Seaton says the two lawmakers spoke about their bills, but they didn't plan them together.
So he asked me, you know, whether that would interfere. I said, no, that'd be good because that's looking at the long term. In other words, talking about future legislatures and what they will do. And this bill is looking at doing an appropriation to accomplish the goal this year while we have control of the budget.
For several years, when there was plenty of money in the general fund, the legislature planned education funding several years in advance. But Wasilla Republican Kathy Tilton is critical of the current bill's approach. She said Thursday that prioritizing education over everything else in the budget doesn't seem fair.
I think that education is a really very an important issue in our state, but I also think that crime has risen and public safety is a very important issue in our state. So if you start to look at the different agencies and where do we decide who's the winners, who's the losers, whose budget gets funded first?
At the end of last school year, hundreds of pink slips went out to untenured teachers across the state. Weeks later, they were hired back when the legislature finally resolved the budget. The House may vote on its bill, HB 287, tomorrow. The Senate bill, SB 131, has been referred to the Senate Finance Committee. You can now get a bachelor's degree on the North Slope. Illisagvik College, Alaska's only tribal college, began offering a Bachelor's of Business Administration this fall. It's part of the college's mission to provide local education for future leaders in the community. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has more.
The main campus for Illisagvik College is located in what's known in Utqiagvik as the Narl Complex. It's the spot where the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory used to be, till it was shuttered about 40 years ago. A short drive north of town, it's a collection of scattered Quonset huts and a boxy blue building lofted up on stilts.
Our main entrance, beautiful view out into the tundra.
That's Pearl Brower, president of the college. Brower says that the vision for higher education on the North Slope began back in the 1970s with the borough's first mayor, Eben Hobson Sr. Hobson felt strongly that local education was the key to self-governance, and he made it one of his top priorities.
He recognized that that was going to be one of the most important things for the future of the North Slope, given the fact that we were playing such a major role in oil and gas development and the fact that we were on the edge of the Arctic in regards to science and climate change.
Over the years, higher education here has gone through several iterations. But in the 90s, Illisagvik College was established in its current form, offering vocational certificates, associate degrees, and short-term workforce development training. And then, this fall, the college launched its very first bachelor's degree program in business administration.
Now, budgets do affect the way people behave. You don't want it to be too easy, you don't want it to be too hard, because then it's not really a motivator.
It's 5:30 p.m., and Professor David Rice is teaching a managerial accounting course to a classroom of five students. The main topic of today's class? Budgets. How you set them, who in an organization should get a say, and the advantages and disadvantages of different types of budgeting tactics.
So budget slack can be good that way, but what can be the problem with budget slack?
You never try to hit the budget because you've got all this slack in there.
It kind of goes back to where it maybe makes it a little bit too easy. You're not running your department very efficiently.
Not all of the students in this class are part of the bachelor's program, but one of them, Roxana N. Evikana, is a brand new enrollee.
I just started literally last week.
Evikana grew up on the North Slope. She did take some college in Anchorage and Washington State, but now that she's back, she's excited that she can work towards her degree without leaving behind the things that are important to her here.
Me and my family try to live a subsistence lifestyle as best as I can. I believe that's what's best for my children growing up, you know, hunting and living the subsistence lifestyle. And being home, being able to go to college at the same time is just is the best.
Evi Khan is an accounting manager for Utqiagvik's Village Corporation. She says she joined the bachelor's program mostly because it was a personal goal of hers, but also because she thinks she may want to open her own business one day.
There's not much entertainment, I believe, so that I'm kind of leaning towards that. Bowling, movies, you know, something fun.
Her professor, David Rice, says that most of the students in the bachelor's program are like Evi Khan. They're not taking the course because they don't have jobs. They're taking it to open up more opportunities down the road.
They're just making sure that they're getting the training so they can move up to upper management. And that keeps the jobs here in the local population. It keeps the money here in the local population. We don't have to bring as many people up from the lower 48 or even from Anchorage.
President Brower echoes this idea. She hopes the bachelor's program will give local students the qualifications they need to fill positions that might otherwise go to applicants from elsewhere.
We see this influx of an outside workforce in our state, but we have every ability to have local control of that. But that takes education. In today's world, it's not the world of our ancestors. And in today's world, we need that education to go along with our indigenous experiences.
While the bachelor's in business administration is Ilisagvik's first, Brower says the college hopes to soon have another. They recently started offering courses in elementary education with an indigenous focus, and they hope to grow it to a bachelor's program in the coming years. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik.
The city of Sitka dealt with a messy situation this past Friday when a vital part of the sewer system failed. A key lift station was down for 36 hours, meaning all raw sewage on Baranof Island had to be diverted into the harbor so it wouldn't back up into homes and businesses. Luckily, as KCAW's Emily Kwong reports, quick-thinking crew members were able to cobble together a solution.
If all roads lead to Rome, you could say that all sewer pipes, at least on the Baranof Island part of Sitka, lead to the Thompson Harbor lift station. But to see it, you have to look down. Environmental Superintendent Shiloh Williams leads me to a hole in the ground, lined with pipe painted light blue and a ladder. We peer over the edge.
You have this can, and then underneath this can is a whole room that houses three very large pumps.
Also in that room is all the equipment necessary to power the pumps that move Sitka's sewage off Baranof Island to a treatment plant on Japonski Island. And around 4:45 Friday morning, one of those three pumps broke apart.
This dry well, which is never supposed to be wet, started filling with sewage. And then it knocked out all of that equipment. And so the lift station was completely dead.
And the water was rising fast. Williams says it was several feet high by the time a floodlight went off and facilities operator Bob Reed arrived.
This was a catastrophic failure. You know, we've never had anything like this happen before. I will say that the crews handled it impeccably. Like this, the repair couldn't have gone any better, any smoother, any faster than it did.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Williams is unmistakably proud of her crew, who worked around the clock to get the situation under control. That included salvaging equipment submerged in sewage and giving the dry well a thorough cleaning. It was messy, back-breaking work, and when asked how her crews managed to deal with the smell, Williams chuckled.
I imagine when they opened it up, it must have been kind of horrific, you know?
You know, they always say that it takes a different breed to be a wastewater operator. And to be honest, it's hardly anything that we even think about.
Especially with the level of emergency. To prevent that river of sewage from backing up into homes and businesses, crews temporarily redirected it towards a storm drain and into the harbor. This pollution posed an environmental concern, so to stem the flow, the city issued a PSA calling for Sickens to limit their toilet flushes and shower times until further notice. Williams said it made a big difference throughout the 36 hours the lift station was ultimately down. She estimates 800,000 gallons of raw sewage entered the harbor in that time.
I mean, I know 800,000 gallons sounds like a lot, but in the scheme of things, into the water that it's discharging into, it could have been a lot worse.
Come Saturday morning, the city had some lucky breaks. It didn't rain, so sewer flow was low, and the two remaining pumps dried out. Crews were able to restore the sewer connection by 5 p.m. that evening. Built in 1982, the Thompson Harbor Lift Station, like many pieces of Sitka infrastructure, is old and due for upgrades. Here's Community Affairs Director Megan Bozak.
The fact that it's aging infrastructure, you know, really is a cause for concern, because if these fails continue to happen, it's very expensive for the taxpayers.
Despite its age and importance, the Thompson Harbor Lift Station is not high on the city's punch list for public works projects. This recent failure has begun a conversation about what can be done sooner. And now that electrical equipment has been installed above ground, away from any potential flooding, Williams said she'd like to see it stay there. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Two Rivers musher Alan Moore is in the driver's seat of the Yukon Quest sled dog race. The two-time Quest champion and perennial frontrunner pulled into the Eagle checkpoint over 300 miles into the race this morning. KUAC's Zoe Rome reports.
The town of Eagle gathered around a roaring fire to await the arrival of musher Alan Moore, the first to arrive at this isolated checkpoint.
All right. Name?
Moore.
After leaving the checkpoint at Circle, Moore mushed to Slavin's Roadhouse in Trout Creek, where he skimped on rest in order to be the first sled in Eagle.
Doing pretty good. They still got a lot of energy. We didn't rest but about 3 hours back at the last place, and they're a little tired now, but we'll give them some rest and they should be pretty perky. Trail couldn't be any better. Whoa. Except for coming in here, a little bit of glare ice. That'll keep you awake. It'll keep those guys awake when they do it at night. It'll be interesting. But the trail's perfect.
Eagle is one of the more remote stops for mushers along the Yukon Quest. More than 100 miles from the previous checkpoint in Circle, and with more than 100 miles to go before arriving at the next checkpoint in Dawson City.
And we get to rest in the heat of the day, whatever that might be.
On the Yukon Quest Trail in Eagle, I'm Zoe Rome.
Moore is being followed by Paige Drobny of Esther and last year's champion Matt Hall, also of Two Rivers. Quest rookie Christine Roloffs is the latest to scratch from the race. She dropped out this morning in Circle. Roloffs was in last place, and a Quest press release says she made the decision out of a concern she would not be able to properly care for her team due to an unspecified personal injury. That leaves 20 mushers on the Quest Trail. Bears play a well-known role in fertilizing Alaska's temperate forests. They catch, carry, and digest fish, spreading nutrients through the undergrowth. But two scientists using remote control cameras near Haines show that bears are making contributions on a different front. They're not just fertilizing seeds, they're planting them. KHNS's Barrett Wilbur has more.
It started when two scientists were overwhelmed by the number of berries in a southeast forest near Haines. Salmon berries, highbush cranberries, soap berries, blueberries, devil's club berries, and more, not just in one or two places, but all throughout the forest. Others might reach for a pie pan. These two thought, these plants must have a really successful reproductive strategy. Lori Herrer is a biology instructor at Central Oregon Community College and Oregon State University, Cascades.
There are just a ton of berry-producing plants in southeast Alaska all throughout the understory, and in particular, devil's club, we noticed, was kind of everywhere. So if it's that prolific and all over the place, then it must have a very successful means of dispersing its seeds around it.
What was it? Tal Levi is an assistant professor of wildlife at Oregon State University. He says they had a guess,
And these fruit in Southeast Alaska appear to be morphologically adapted for birds because they're small berries. In case the devil's club, small red berry.
So the two set up a study. Over two summers, they identified more than 400 clusters of berries in a stretch of forest about 30 miles north of Haines. They calculated an average number of berries per plant. They trained motion-triggered cameras on the plants to see what was eating them. And what they found was a surprise. Bears weren't just eating more berries, they were eating magnitudes more berries. The two scientists estimated a single bear could eat over 100,000 berries an hour. Robins and thrushes couldn't begin to keep up. Bears were like cargo carriers, taking seeds in their stomachs far away from the original berry patch, Herrer says.
The whole reason why they even want their seeds to be dispersed in the first place is so that you don't have the parent plant competing with its offspring plants growing up in the exact same area, competing for resources and sunlight.
Bears were helping plants fulfill their biological imperative to reproduce without sacrificing their own access to resources. And dispersed berries had a better chance than those that just dropped from the bush, Levi says. When bears finally released the seeds, they left something to help them grow.
They're deposited in a place that was just fertilized by bear scat and has good moisture retention. It's like this little batch of potting soil that seed is left in.
Based on their research, Levi and Herrer believe bears are the most important seed dispersers in the region for berries. While jungle plants often depend on mammals to eat their fruit and carry their seeds to new places, the scientists say it's the first known temperate example of plants relying on a mammal's digestive tract as their primary method to travel.
Because there's so many bears, if they really truly are the most important seed dispersers, that sort of is understandable then why you have so many more berries in Alaska.
But bears aren't the only animals contributing to better berry hauls, the scientists say. Salmon are, too. Dependable salmon runs help Alaska maintain its high density of large bears, compared to places on the east and west coast where bear populations have dwindled and salmon no longer return.
A large population of bears spreading berry seeds is helping those understory plants grow, so that salmon supporting that bear population is vital for bears to then help assist all of those berry-producing plants.
Levi says it's likely that losing salmon could have changed the growth of burying plants in those areas because they could no longer travel in the bellies of the bears. In Haines, I'm Barrett Wilbur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Russell in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jacob Resnick and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Zoe Rome in Eagle, and Barrett Wilbur in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Rachel Waldholtz. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.